work. We'll see. So I would also like to thank Bridget and Clint and Ron for inviting me to this this final workshop down here in sunny Southern California. This was the list of questions that I was assigned for this session. Now, the last two questions at the bottom were things that they asked me, well, what do you want to talk about? So I don't feel too bad that I'm going to not talk about that and replaced it with something else. And I guess I'll find out when they hold their next workshop whether they approved of my change or not. Over the last couple of days, I saw a bunch of things which led me to talking about this this other topic, which is, can we discriminate between good data and bad data in a numerical way, in a way that a novice could actually look at it and say, ah, that must be good data, that must be bad data. I think it fits in a lot better with some of what we've been hearing, and Nico just did a great job in classification, so might as well. Now, I've used this slide about five times so far this year, and this is just to point out, this is the number of maps at different resolutions that are being deposited into the EM data bank every year. Now, I'm not using the slide for the same purpose. We can see that, you know, there is definitely a growing percentage down here, and I imagine if we include this year's statistics, we're going to see this number getting much bigger. But still, the vast majority of structures in the field are at lower resolution, and there's got to be some reason why that's the case. Why isn't everyone getting these really high-resolution structures? Okay, so I'm going to start out with a little bit of a mystery here. I'm going to show you a plot, and I have not labeled the axes in the plot, and I'm going to show you a few different plots, and then I'll explain what it is. So a little backwards. Okay, so what I've done is I've gone out and I've taken some public data sets, some data sets from our own group and collaborations that we have and stuff like that, and I've made these plots. I will tell you that each point in this plot represents a micrograph or a CCD frame. So this was the TRP V1 data from UCSF. You can see it makes this nice scatter. Now, of course, since you don't know what the axes are, you don't know how to interpret this, so let's add some more. Here is the ribosome data set that Shores made publicly available. That was about 4.6 angstroms, and you can see it's in the same sort of general ballpark, although it's maybe shifted over to one side a little bit. I'm going to leave those up, and then I'm going to show you some others. Go ahead. I'm going to tell you what it is, I promise. I'm going to convince you that it's useful first, and then I'm going to tell you how it works. It's not really magic or anything. It's nothing all that complicated. I fear everyone's going to go to sleep otherwise, right? Okay. So this is a ribosome channel that Chris Akey published recently, and it was collected on his F20 with a 4K CCD camera. Now, you'll notice that it's in a decidedly different region of the plot. Now, here's another data set. This, I can't tell you what this data set was, but it was collected on a Krios with a K2. It got stuck at an 8 angstrom resolution as well. So you'll notice that not all of the data that's collected on good instruments is up in that same region of the plot. Okay, here's another data set. This is a GROW-EL data set collected recently as a control at the NCMI, and it was collected on our JOLE 3200 with a DE20. And again, it's sort of overlapping with the first set. Here's another GROW-EL, but this is a GROW-EL complex, and it was collected on the same instrument with the same parameters by the same microscopist. The same guy did the freezing. Everything was basically the same. The only difference was it was a more complicated system. And you can see that one's down there, and it only went to about 6.5 angstroms. Here's BMV, which we published recently. You can see that one's off to the left, but it's up pretty high up there. That went to 3.8 angstroms, and again, that was on a JOLE 3200. That was with a DE12, though, not even a DE20. All right, so particle-based quality assessment. So we're going to start out with this. The traditional way that people evaluate their images in the field, if they evaluate them at all, because I've noticed, unfortunately, a large number of people don't, is to chop up your micrograph into these little squares. You take the Fourier transform of all the squares and you compute a power spectrum and you average together. The reason you use the little squares is just to get better statistics so the power spectrum isn't so noisy. And you do that and you'll see a one-dimensional power spectrum that looks something like this, hopefully. Now this, was done on an old data set. I had these slides handy. This was, you know, something I put together several years ago. It doesn't go to really high resolution, but the concept is the same, so I didn't want to have to remake all the slides. So what you see is these nice tone rings going out to high resolution, not super high in this case, but to high resolution. Now, this is the basis for most people assessing their data. Now, what we can do is we can connect the zeros of the CTF, basically, and then we can do a background subtracted curve, and then we can fit the functional form of the CTF to that. Now, of course, you don't get an exact fit because the specimen in the image has a structure factor, and that structure factor is involved in the computation. So if we do this a little bit better, we'll see that our measured curve here, the oscillatory curve there, that's M, consists of a structure factor, a one-dimensional structure factor, multiplied by a CTF and an envelope function, and then there's some amount of additive noise. Now, I put noise in quotes there because noise has different meanings in different contexts. Now, if your goal is to look at the quality of the image from the microscope perspective, did I do a good job aligning my microscope? Is it producing high-quality data? this is fine. This is a great way of going about things. It'll tell you, you know, how far out your signal is going. But from a is my data good and is it going to get me to high resolution? Is my single particle data good? Perspective, this is not quite as useful, and that's what I'll explain why. So we can compute something, a spectral signal-to-noise ratio. So you've heard the term signal-to-noise ratio before, I'm sure. It's just exactly what it sounds like. It's the ratio of the amount of signal to the amount of noise. Spectral signal-to-noise ratio is the same thing. It's just chopped up by spatial frequency. So you can say at each resolution range how much signal and how much noise there is. And we can compute that really easily from a curve like this. We just take the total curve minus the noise part of the curve, and then we divide by the noise part of the curve. So everything above this noise curve is considered to be signal. Now, if we do that, we get some interesting results. Now, this, again, as I said, is an old example. This was the IP3 receptor talk that I've given for the last couple of years, talking about how, well, in 2002 we published this horrible, crappy structure, which was wrong, and so did a bunch of other people. And then in 2011 we corrected it with a nice structure, and then comparing the raw data. So this was the raw data from 2002 and the raw data from 2011. And you can see these nice isolated particles here, and over here, well, there are particles and stuff floating around maybe, but, you know, given these two, you would say, oh, well, I want to use this one, but if all you have is this one, can I look at it and say, is it good, is it bad? What's going on? Now, if we do the thing that I just showed you with the power spectrum, computing the spectral signal-to-noise ratio on these two data sets, this is what we see. The new data set has a peak signal-to-noise ratio of about 1.2, and then it sort of decays, and it goes out to a fairly high resolution here. The old data set also peaks at about 1.2, it falls off a little bit more quickly, but since this is like a 25 angstrom resolution structure, this is a little bit better. But since this was ostensibly like a 25 angstrom resolution structure, that doesn't really impact us, right? Because we're only looking at this anyway. So you'd say that on that basis, these two data sets are actually somewhat equivalent. There's really no basis for throwing this data away. It was fine quality. It was collected on a Joel 1200, right, on film. So it wasn't, that's why it doesn't go out to high resolution. Okay, so the problem comes in with our definition of what noise is. So far we've been defining noise on the terms of what is noise in the microscope, what is the true noise being produced by the detector system and everything like that. However, from the perspective of single particle reconstruction, noise has a completely different definition. Noise, in that definition, is anything which isn't a perfect particle that's going to give me my reconstruction. If you have other stuff floating around the ice, that's noise. If you have carbon film, or if you have detergent in the buffer, all of those things are producing things which are noise from the perspective of a single particle reconstruction. Now, a lot of people get really tricky about this, and they make assumptions about the statistics, and they say, oh, well, I have nice uniform distributed white noise. And that's more or less true from the microscope perspective, but from the single particle perspective, The noise may be, you know, discrete lumps in the ice. It may be highly localized. It doesn't have the same sort of statistical characteristics that you have that you have with a detector and that sort of thing. Okay. So can we do better? So the approach that we've pretty much always used in EMAN 2 is to look at particles rather than regions of the micrograph. So we box out the particles. Now the question is, okay, so the particles give us our signal. There's going to be noise in the background as well. So from the particles, we'll get sort of signal plus noise. How do we get the noise term? Well, one approach would be we can box out areas of the background where there aren't any particles and say anything there must be noise for the purposes of this algorithm. And that's an okay approach, but it doesn't always work because sometimes we have cases like this where you can't really find enough areas in the ice to get enough signal for your noise measurement. Right? Because you really like to have an equal number of boxes of background as you have boxes of with particles in them to make this assessment work well. So the solution that we adopted to this problem is this. We take our set of particles, so these are Gröhe-L particles floating around in ice, and we multiply all the particles by a mask and get something like that. So this mask, it's got a Gaussian edge, it's very soft, but it sort of separates the middle of the image from the edge of the image. And you can see it's slicing off a little bit of the edge of our particles, but it's not too bad. We're pretty much getting particles. And then we use the opposite mask, the one minus that mask with a little apodization at the edge. And we do the same thing. And this basically wipes out the particle in the middle of the box and leaves us only with this noise at the edge of the box. And if we're very careful with our math, we can compute the power spectrum of this, the power spectrum of this, and then we can use that to compute the signal-to-noise ratio. Now, it's not going to be absolutely perfect, but it'll be pretty good. One of the problems with this approach, which you actually have already seen the results of, is if the particle density is very high, you know, if the particles are all crammed up against each other in the ice, then you've got a lot of stray particle density in the corners, and that will make you underestimate your signal-to-noise ratio because it'll treat some of that as if it were noise. But it will never make you overestimate your signal-to-noise ratio. It'll only make you underestimate it. And that happens mostly at low resolution, and it really only has a significant impact if the density is really, really high. So the case where we saw it, and we'll get back to it in a second, is with the BMV virus particles, where they were really almost hexagonally packed in the ice in cases. And that's why we saw it sort of shifted off to the left, even though it was a high-resolution structure. So we're going to redo our analysis now. We're going to show this curve is what we got when we multiplied our images by that mask. And this is the curve that we got when we multiplied our particles by the inverted mask. And you can see this is quite a bit different than that. Right? So not only were we treating this as if it were signal when it was really noise, so we have a sort of a double whammy. We've overestimated our signal, and we've underestimated our noise. So this has a very strong impact on the signal-to-noise ratio that you say you have for purposes of single particle reconstruction. Okay? So when we apply that to the new data set, these particles, using this new strategy that's particle-based, we get something that looks like this. You can see our signal-to-noise ratio at low resolution is actually quite high now. It's like 2 or 3 at the peak values, and it extends out pretty far, and it's pretty decent. Now, if we do the same thing with the this was the comparison to the old estimation method. So you can see we've underestimated the signal-to-noise ratio in here, and we've overestimated it in other places. And now we do the same thing with the old particle data, and this red curve was the old estimate using the micrograph-based method, and this is the new estimate. We can see, for the purposes of single particle reconstruction, our peak signal-to-noise ratio was only 0.2. Quite a big difference from 1.2. So now if we compare those side by side, before and after, now we think they're equivalent. Now we don't think they're equivalent anymore. Now we would say, okay, we can throw this away. Now this is a great, like I said, I've been giving this little talk for a couple of years and sort of pointing this fact out, but this is mostly sort of a low resolution thing. Should I process my data or should I throw it in the trash can before I even try? This same concept easily extends to high resolution, however. Once we have these spatial signal-to-noise ratio curves, the curves themselves are a little bit noisy, but if we integrate them over a range of resolutions, we can get pretty good numbers out of them. So what we'll do is we'll take two ranges. We'll take one range, which goes from 20 angstroms to out to about 200 angstroms, and we'll take the average signal-to-noise ratio over that range, integrate and divide by the width. And then we'll do another curve where we start at 10 angstroms and we go out to 4 angstroms, which in this case, obviously, isn't all that meaningful, but that's what I did in the other cases. And we'll compute that. So we plot the low-resolution signal-to-noise ratio on the x-axis. Now you know what the plot is. And the high-resolution signal-to-noise ratio on the y-axis. So the x-axis is sort of telling you, for each micrograph, whether you have a significant amount of contrast. And that contrast would be what you need to get low-resolution alignments to work, or even high-resolution alignments, to get your alignments to work at all. Then the vertical axis tells you whether there's good information content there for doing a high-resolution refinement. Now, this just discriminates into sort of two groups. I mean, we could change the ranges. It doesn't have to be 4 to 10 angstroms. You could use some other range. This is basically going to tell you, if you're down here, if your micrographs are down there, you are not going to get anything out. You might as well not even process the data. If you are over here, you should be able to get to sort of 10 angstrom, you know, sort of sub-nanometer resolution, but you're probably not going to get to near atomic resolution. And if you're up here, you have the expectation you should be able to get to atomic resolution unless something else interferes, like heterogeneity or something like that. But the image data itself should be good enough to get you to high resolution. Now, the nice thing about this plot is it's pretty easy to produce. You don't have to box out your micrographs well. You do need to have particles boxed out. But you can just use a quick auto-boxer, and even it boxes out a lot of junk as well. It's still going to give you a pretty good estimate of the signal-to-noise ratio from sort of a general particle perspective. If you have heterogeneity, then that's a separate issue you're going to have to deal with anyway. So you can just do sort of a quick auto-box on your micrograph, and you can quickly get an assessment of whether your data is up there or whether it's down there, you know, whether you need to better optimize your conditions. Now, in my experience, the main reason something goes on this axis vertically is ice thickness, as we've been hearing throughout this thing. Getting your ice thickness right, getting your carbon film thickness right, getting your buffer conditions so it doesn't have a lot of big molecules in it which are scattering and causing you false signal is really, really the key factor in getting good data. As we saw from my plots there where I was showing you stuff from all different microscopes, all different detectors, obviously getting a direct detector is a world of difference, right? Without the direct detectors, we would not be getting these high-resolution structures. But which microscope you use, I mean, Bridget and Clint just recently showed you could do it on a 200 kV microscope, not super high-end. Don't have to have a terrific microscope to get pretty nice high-resolution data. Now, this is just sort of showing visually the impact. I had never made these curves until a few months ago when one of our collaborators, who was kind of a beginner in the field, said, you keep looking at these images and you say, that's a good image and that's a bad image. What in the heck are you doing? Because someone who's experienced in the field can look at them and sort of say, well, that's high contrast, that's low contrast. They can look at the power spectrum and say, oh, yeah, that's good, that's bad, pretty much. So that's when I sort of decided I would formalize this so anyone can look at one of these plots and say, it's in the good region, it's in the bad region. So if we look along the x-axis, it's pretty obvious. These are nice high-contrast particles. These are pretty low-contrast particles. So this had a value of about 0.1, and this had a value of about 0.8. On the vertical axis, it's not so easy to see by eye. If you're really good at sort of picturing Fourier space, you might be able to do something. So we can do a couple of other sorts of comparisons with these numbers. So this is a plot of Shor's ribosome data set, where we're plotting the low-resolution signal-to-noise ratio on the vertical axis, and we're plotting defocus on the x-axis. So what's the relationship between contrast and defocus? And as you would hope, you see this nice, somewhat linear relationship. But you'll also notice there's a pretty big scatter on the curve. And these low-resolution signal-to-noise ratios are pretty accurate. The error bars on these spots vertically here are pretty small. So this really indicates that even in a pretty good data set, you actually will have a fair bit of ice thickness variation or image quality variation going on. Now let's look at another example. Yeah? I would say you don't, if you discard the bad ones, you can get an equivalent reconstruction. But the bad ones don't usually really hurt anything. You know, most of the algorithms that we're using nowadays are good enough that they don't weight those crappy particles very heavily. So it doesn't hurt you too much. but certainly it costs you a lot of excess processing time, and it might actually give you a better, probably won't give you a better resolution, but it may give you a better looking map. That's a careful distinction to make. So this is what happens if we look at that CCD data of Chris Akey's, and you can see that the relationship isn't nearly as strong here. And this just indicates that there are issues here with ice thickness, right, where a lot of the particles, the ice was too thick. Now note here that the lowest value here is still something like 0.3, and a 0.3, 0.4 is high enough that you should be able to get your alignments pretty well anyway. So the data set, almost this entire data set was probably still fine for the sort of sub-nanometer resolution that he was getting in that case. But nonetheless, if he had had a data set which had a relationship more like this, he probably would have been getting better results at that time. Okay, here's another example. This is back to Shores, but now instead of looking at the instead of looking at the low resolution signal-to-noise ratio versus defocus, now we're looking at the high resolution signal-to-noise ratio versus defocus. Now in this curve, you might expect to see an inverse linear relationship. It doesn't have to be linear, but an inverse relationship. And you can see maybe a little bit of that, right? So at higher defocus, you have a little bit worse high resolution signal. And it's as much as a factor of 2 here with the closer to focus images, but it's not sort of the same kind of linear curve that you saw before. However, if we look at another example, so this is the GROW-EL data set I was showing you before, we can see again, this is low resolution again on this axis, we can see again we have a nice linear relationship, and if we look at the defocus relationship there for the high resolution data, we can see we actually do see a pretty strong inverse linear relationship. Once you get beyond about 1.5 microns, you really begin to lose some of that high resolution signal in this case.
Steve, yeah?
This is the traditional relationship between the B factor of the instrument and the defocus, which is supposed to be much better if you have field emission guns versus not field emission guns. And I would say that it was certainly a very large factor. I mean, when we went from not having a FEG to having a FEG, the slope of this curve improved dramatically.
But also that if you have a parallel beam and not having a more...
That can have an effect too, yes, of course. This was done under very careful parallel beam conditions. So there's still a pretty significant effect. Okay, so that's the end of this little section of the talk. It's a fairly robust assessment, which is immune to most of the sort of confounders that you might have, which might make you think your data is better than it actually is. It doesn't require actually doing a whole reconstruction before you find out whether your data is likely to be good or not. You do have to box out particles, but you don't have to do a good job of it. And as I mentioned before, the very high particle density may cause you some artifact. It may shift your curves to the left. It usually doesn't impact the vertical axis, the high resolution axis too much. So if you have a very high density and you see, my contrast looks unusually low, you may not have to worry about it as much as you might otherwise think. And this is all sort of a standard part of EMAN's processing pipeline. If you want to play with it, and I'm sure other people could easily implement the same general concept. Okay, now I'm going to move on to something else. Now, I wanted to do a little, share a few of the results. One of my students, part of his PhD thesis now, is comparing some of the different software packages. So we've done a lot of work to make it easy to move data between EMAN and Reline and Freeline and now CTFind, and we're using the EMX and stuff. So we've been trying to make it easy to move data back and forth. And we're trying to do some comparative studies to see if there's things that the software packages can learn from each other in their reconstruction quality. I had a terrific example planned for this workshop, but based on sort of Yifan's comment the other day, my collaborators absolutely forbade me to discuss it here. So I've gone back to GROW-EL. Now this is a new GROW-EL dataset, which Hua got one of his students to collect as basically a control specimen for the 3200 with the DE20. So this is the same data set that I showed you on the plot before. So there were 85,000 particles in this data set. It got to about 4.3 angstrom resolution with the current EMAN 2.1, and that's without doing any per particle alignment. I got this data set last week. I just haven't had time to sort of fully do anything with it yet. But it very, very quickly went to 4.3 angstroms. Now, again, I just got the data set last week, and I had to very quickly put some slides together for here, so I chopped the data set down to a more manageable size. So I took 5,000 of the particles out. They're not the 5,000 best particles, but they are from sort of the good part of that plot. So from the 5,000 particle data set, I could get to, oh, I guess I didn't put the resolution up there. I will show the resolution in a second, sorry. So I get this structure, which is a little worse resolution, but it's not dramatically worse resolution visually. You can still see, you know, sort of lumpy alpha helices. In this structure, I'm not digging into it in great detail, but if you look at some of the beta sheets, the strands are very, very clearly resolved. You can see big side chains. It's you know, it's a nice map. It's just Gurriel, though. In this map, the strand separation is not nearly as well resolved, but you can still see it looks fairly nice. So this was done with EMAN 2.1. And here's the same data set processed with real onion. So we can switch back and forth a little bit between these. You can see they're not absolutely identical, but the overall visual quality is similar. Now you'll see there are some directional effects. You can find some places, like if you look at this helix, it seems like Reliant has a slightly nicer appearance there. But if you look up here, you'll actually see some places where the density is broken in Reliant and it's connected in EMAN. So in some places in the map, one looks better. In some places, the other looks better. I would say that the structures are pretty equivalent. You can't really expect to get much more equivalent maps than this with two different software packages. Now, when we look at the resolution of the map, this is what we see. So the Reliant curve is in black, and the EMAN curve was in blue. Now, most people who would see this would say, I want the Reliant curve. It's 4.6, not 4.8 angstroms, right? It's obviously better. All right, now I did something a little bit different here with the FSC curve in EMAN, and I'm going to give you another example before I explain. And I can also make the EMAN curve look like that. So what's going on? All right, now I've got another example. So my second example is Shor's ribosome dataset. So this is the 20,000 particle subset. I didn't try to do my own 2D classification, and in this case, we didn't even do any per particle alignment. This was just a very simple test with 20,000 particles just averaged together. So we don't expect it to get to the 4.7 angstroms or whatever that 4.6, I guess, that was in the original publication. But he also talked about this data set in his publication, and it came out to something in the low fives. So this was processed with EMAN 2.1, and then again, here's the Reliant processed version of it. And there's a few more differences this time, and there's actually some things we can learn from this. The big difference between this data set and the Gruyel data set is this has very, very strongly preferred orientation. So the thing that you get out of this is that while both packages produce nice-looking structures, they deal with that anisotropy of the data orientations slightly differently. So the way it goes into the reconstruction. Now, how do you say which one is better? I mean, neither of these data of these reconstructions have the sort of directional smearing that you may see in some ribosomes when you have sort of pushed the resolution too far from that anisotropy. Certainly there are some local differences between these two sets. Still, again, I would say that you don't really expect that any two software packages are going to produce anything a whole lot closer than that. And again, if we do our resolution plots here, we can see, the Reliant map is just a little bit better than the EMAN map. So this seems to be a recurring theme, and that obviously didn't like that very much. So I tried to look and figure out why. This is the answer. This is something that you can't detect at all with isosurfaces. So my student looked at, who did this, you know, this reconstruction, looked at the isosurface in the two packages and said, look, they look very much the same. There's nothing different. But this goes back to sort of a debate that we had, I don't know, 10 years ago or something like that in the field about when you measure resolution, how much should you mask your data? Now, back in the days when we still had a lot of model bias and that sort of thing, the argument was you shouldn't mask it at all, you should sort of have unmasked data. But then that has the problem that if you have a bigger box size, you have more noise, and it makes your resolutions worse, which encourages people to use these tiny boxes, which then have lots of edge artifacts. And so there were lots of arguments about it, and there was never any complete conclusion. I think at the end, the conclusion for the EM data bank was you should deposit your unmasked volume, and then you could mask it however you wanted and sort of compute the resolution, but you really shouldn't mask too tightly. Anyway, now we have the sort of gold standard reconstruction. So in theory, our two maps are independent, and you could mask them independently too. And if it doesn't impact your ISO surface, you could make an argument that, well, maybe it's okay to mask highly. You know, if you're not changing the appearance of the reconstruction, maybe that's really the resolution that you want to measure. In any case, EMAN has always used this sort of softer, more traditional mask. I mean, it's bigger. And in both cases, of course, the user has some control, has the ability to control it. This is what EMAN produces by default, and this is what my student produced sort of following Shore's general recommendations. So again, I'm not saying there's anything wrong in either case. I'm just saying that that's what caused the difference in this case. And I actually wanted to open it up for discussion here, because I think it's kind of an interesting thing we should talk about. So back here again, this is the other one I wanted to show. So these are three different curves you can get. This is with basically just a spherical soft-edged mask. Then this is sort of using EMAN's default values, and then this is using an aggressive mask in EMAN. This is 4.7 angstrom. Sorry, this is after I did EMAN's... EMAN also has per-particle movie mode alignment. So when I did that, with an aggressive mask, I also get to basically the same resolution Shore's claim for the same data set. So again, which of these three curves is the right one to claim for your resolution? You could say, well, it doesn't really matter, but I don't know, 4.7 angstroms versus maybe 5.3 angstroms, to a lot of people, that's a big difference. I, myself included, I'd rather say 4.7 than 5.3. I have unfortunately seen a number of people who have been playing with Relion recently avoiding Shore's advice and taking this to extremes. So what they do is they take the Relion post-processing thing and they keep adjusting the parameters to get the best possible resolution value they can claim. So if you take it too far, it starts really cutting into your map strongly and the resolution starts getting worse again. So they sort of find the minimum, you know, where it gives them the best possible resolution value, and whatever the mask parameters are there, that's what they use. And I can't entirely blame them for being tempted by doing that approach, but...
What about the correction? The mask effect is also being corrected, right?
The mask is always being corrected. What do you want to respond? I don't know what he means.
I think there's a misunderstanding.
Okay.
So masks have two effects on your FSC curve.
Right.
One is the one you want.
Yep.
It removes noise
from
the
solvent. Right, solvent flattening, basically.
And
right.
that is the good thing. Yep. The other thing, it's a multiplication in real space,
right,
which is a convolution in the Fourier domain.
Right.
So very strong low-frequency components, which correlate well, get mixed in with high-frequency components, which shouldn't correlate. Right.
Right?
So
right.
There's two effects, and we'd rather have all of the masking
the solvent
flattening and
okay,
we would like to get rid of all of the convolution. So
yeah.
What Relion does, and that's actually, if you saw the Relion curve, there was this little dip.
Yeah.
Uh-huh. Yeah, and that's a consequence, yeah, the blue one, the little dip.
Yeah.
So you do this phase randomization beyond that resolution, and you measure the effect of the convolution, and then you do a correction. Now, because of some spilling over in neighboring shells, you get that little dip. But what you get is something which is supposedly corrected for the convolution. And if you do that too strongly, that's exactly what you described, then you cut in density, and the resolution gets worse because kind of this overcorrects. Okay?
Right.
I think, therefore, it is actually very well justified. You can just play with this mask and kind of get the highest
resolution.
Okay,
well, we can do this. We can do the same thing.
This is something
too.
You can very easily implement.
I guess the question is, I mean, as a community, well, all right, I think we should maybe hold this off until the discussion. So I've got a few more minutes left, 5 more minutes or so. So let me just finish off my talk, and then we can make this part of the panel or something. So just the last thing I want to say, I'm going to use just a couple slides for advertising. We've been developing this 2.1 release of Eman for like 2.5 years now or something. We released it, finally. So Eman 2.1 is now available. Sparks is, of course, distributed, co-distributed with it, but Powell doesn't use numerical numbers with his, so Sparks is there in the same version. So it now does gold standard refinements as basically the only way you can do refinements with heuristic parameters, and I'll show you what that means in a second. It generates refinement reports for you with FSC curves and everything like that and automatically filters your maps in a way basically the same way Shores was describing. We have multi-model 3D classification. One nice thing is one of my students spent most of his PhD building up this big set of subtomogram averaging tools, and we're finally getting that paper out now. I have a draft that's supposed to get sent off last week, but it'll go off real soon now. Documenting that. The biggest thing, I think, for people who played with Eman 2.0 and said, oh my god, it was terrible, I had this database thing and it kept crashing on me and it was such a pain, we eliminated that. It is not used anymore at all. All files are now stored in flat image files with human-readable text files containing all of the metadata. Yeah. Yes, I think that's mostly because it takes a little bit of pain for the programmer to go through and recode it, rather than any real intrinsic hate he has for, you know, I don't know. Powell can certainly comment. I always tell my students, speed is the last thing anyone wants to hear about. They want to get the best quality reconstructions. Not the best speed. If it takes 10 times longer and you get a better reconstruction, you wait 10 times longer. But I will say that I think we're getting basically equivalent quality maps to rely on, and that Eman tends to be about 10 to 20 times faster in achieving it because it doesn't have to do all the likelihood integration. It uses other strategies to achieve its results. We incorporated tilt validation, and we've spent a fair bit of effort now. You can take, if you've done an Eman refinement, you can just, in one step, convert it to a Relion project and run a Relion refinement. If you have a Relion refinement, you can import that and it'll turn it into an Eman 2 project so you can do comparative work. For FreeAlign, we only have it going one way, not the other way. So you can go from Eman into FreeAlign and do the same thing. You can import CTFind 3 parameters if you prefer them. And for astigmatism, I will agree, CTFind does a very nice job. I can demonstrate very well that the per particle thing that Eman does works great for defocus. And if you plot CTFind 3 versus Eman defocus, it's a straight linear curve with very small deviations. But for astigmatism, CTFind 3 and the whole micrograph does a very nice job. And of course, there's this new EMX thing that we've been coming out. That's the electron microscopy exchange format. The goal is that we shouldn't have to write these scripts to convert things from one package to another all the time. Just about done. I just was comparing here. So this was what you had to do in Eman 2.0 to run a refinement. At the request of users, actually, we added all of this control and options, but that meant that you had to understand what all those options meant. In Eman 2.1, that's the command. Basically, you have to tell it target the resolution range you're expecting to target, and then just the basic imaging parameters, and it will use heuristics to figure everything out. The last point is training. We haven't had a workshop in a few years, and that's because of the loss of our site and going through a grant renewal and all sorts of other things. I have started doing these online Google Hangout on Air sessions every other week or so, and they get archived. And of course, we've got the wiki and training material. Some of these questions are more like, what should centers do? And I think we're there yet. If you have good data and you refine it, most of the software packages out there will get you pretty equivalent results. If you have bad data and you put it into the programs, you'll get different results in different packages. So it's actually can be important to do comparative refinements just to sort of make sure that you're really getting self-consistency. And I think any lab can do it if you have good data. I don't know that any lab can do it if you don't have good data. I'm going to leave that one alone right now. And with that, I'm just going to finish with acknowledgments. So Hun in Waz lab collected all that nice GROW-EL data set with almost no gain so far. Hopefully he'll be on a paper at some point. And my student Stephen Murray is the one who's been doing all these comparative analyses between the various software packages. And the IP3 example I used was this big collaboration between Arena's lab and Juan himself and other people. That's it.